Hi, folks. Thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it. My name is Mark Manassi. Has anybody here ever heard of me? All right, good. No, I just...
Wow.
I like to avoid introductions if I can. You may not know my friend here. All right, fine. We won't do that. Mark and I like to get up on stage together, and one of the things we do, he was kind enough to ask me to come up and to interview him about the cloud. We've done this a few times, and it's been a whole lot of fun. So I've got some ideas. Your ideas are welcome as well. I got some when I was walking around. So anyway, our plan's going to be I'm going to ask him some questions, and he'll answer them. And if you think he's lying, you go, no. And we won't do that. We won't do that. I'll be the one saying that. So let's get started.
All right.
Let's get started. So the first thing, you know what?
What?
Let's ask them some questions first.
All right.
How many of you have an Azure virtual machine that you're running and using? Okay.
That's good. Let me ask the next question.
Yes.
How many of you have an Amazon virtual machine? Never mind. No, it's actually, I think there were a lot more Azures than Amazons in there.
I thought there were. That's because it's not the Amazon conference.
But I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, so anybody doing an Amazon, anybody doing an, they all start with A.
Yeah.
If you guys had chosen, you know, Amazon comes before Azure. If you come up with like ABC, that would have been better. So how many of you have a cloud service, an Azure cloud service? Anybody running one of those? Okay, good. So I'm hearing that a lot of you are not yet in the cloud, and you're still a little bit nervous about it. Well, let's see if we can't find some things out that might.
Yeah, how many people have done nothing with the cloud yet? So quite a few of you. How many people don't know what the cloud is and are hoping for a definition at the start of it?
Okay. How many of you wouldn't raise your hand no matter what we asked you? That's what it is. So I want to start off with the way that the cloud, kind of an odd question. I'm going to argue that the cloud has benefits for even those of us, I'm a cloud Gnostic, but for even those of us who are not so sure about clouds,
yeah.
And the benefit is, when I first saw Server 2012, I first saw it, I guess, at Build a couple of years ago, April of the 2011, I was astounded at how much new stuff there was. Has anyone here rolled out 2012 at all, Server 2012? Uh-huh. I'm frankly astonished at the goodies. There's a SAN, there's like network teaming, it's like someone there uses the product. It's astounding. And I'm thinking about this, and I thought, oh, duh. Microsoft's running one of the largest data centers in the world. How many servers? Can you tell us how many servers?
I can't tell you how many servers now.
Okay, I've heard numbers of nearly or over a million physical servers are in Azure. My understanding is that last year, one statistic I heard from a Microsoft person was that 17% of the server hardware purchased in the world was purchased by Microsoft as part of Azure. So the cool thing is, none of us have ever had to manage a data center that size. And so it looked to me like, and I said to you a couple years ago, it looks like these are things you come up with in Azure that you just said, let's put it in server, right?
Yep. Well, yeah, go ahead.
Talk.
So first I want to talk about this, the growth of the scale that you're talking about, because I can't tell you the exact numbers that we've got, and it's changing literally every minute we're installing servers. We expect to double our capacity in the next year and then double it again the year after off of the number kind of scales that you were in the ballpark of.
You're going to buy that many servers?
We are.
What vendor do you buy servers from? I just want to know so I'm buying stock.
You can buy the same type of server because we released the spec for it to the Open Computer.
So you have a custom machine.
That's right.
Very nice. Yeah. Very nice. Okay. The question here is, to me, if you've ever done any software development, one of the problems, I think, is that if Mark's working you were in the Windows team for a long time, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you had some great idea, you'd say, hey, boss, I want to do this, and the boss would say, well, we got a new version of Windows in 24 months. You can have 18 months, and if it takes you 18 months and a day, I'm sorry, it doesn't go in that version of Windows, right?
Yep.
How often do they build Azure? It's not every 2 years.
We're building it all the time, actually. So
I always say two weeks, but I realize there's a million different...
you can't really say Azure and say Azure's being built every week, because Azure consists of dozens and dozens of components and services that are each on their own cadence of releases and builds. He hates the word cadence, so I use it
all. There's always a Microsoft word, you know, beautiful or, you know, cadence.
Yeah, reimagine.
Reimagine. There was a new one we saw. That's in the drinking game. So... how is that going to relate to server in the future?
So what you see going on is actually the pace of change in the cloud is at that kind of pace that we've just been talking about, which is certain components are really pushing to the cloud every day. Some are pushing every week, some are pushing every 3 weeks. It kind of depends on where they are in the stack and where they are in the engineering evolution, because a lot of products and a lot of teams come from engineering systems and cultures that are more box product oriented, so they've come from that way, and it really is a journey of learning how to ship fast and get code out into production fast, that a lot of teams are making at their own pace, because Microsoft's a big company and lots of people are involved with this. But the server guys are also now getting into the same rhythm of things. So one of the challenges that we had working in Azure on pieces of Windows that we wanted to ship into Azure is that the server guys are off in their multi-year release, the Server 2012 or R2, and we've got some features that we want to put into Azure like tomorrow. And so we have to figure out, we go to them, we say, hey, this is what we want to do. They say, we're busy, our plans are already booked. And so what we did originally, this is the original way that Azure formed, is there was a fork of Windows. The Windows Server and the Hypervisor, this is Dave Cutler's fork of Hyper-V to make it support some of the features that Azure needed, like boot from VHD, like support for 8-core VMs, things that Hyper-V didn't have at the time. And we released that. And then what happened at the end of that release, the Server 2012 release, we all realized the cloud thing has got a different way of, a different pace of pushing things out, and we need to make sure that we're not forking and going off in our own directions, because that's bad for, it's bad for server business, it's bad for Azure business to have two different code bases that we're having to port features back and forth across. So let's try to make it so that it's not a fork, it's basically a temporary branch off with a remerge as soon as possible. And so that's the model that gone into. Yeah, like this. It's constantly going like this.
The mathematicians in the room will know this is called an osculating function that looks like this. There's only two mathematicians in the room. Keep going.
And so the SQL team does the same thing. And where the box product, the SQL Server 2014 release, based off a lot of stuff that came out of the cloud. And what we do then is, as these features get pushed into the cloud, the box product team is looking at saying which ones can we pick up by which times so that it gets into the box product test cycle, because testing for on-premises products is different than the cloud. We do a lot of testing in production in the cloud, which is we roll things out to pilot clusters, the test clusters, slices in production. We get more confidence over that, like really running customer workloads on top of the thing before then we go out and push it out to the world. And that allows us to push these features out very quickly with a high degree of confidence. With a box product like server that we sell to IT pros that are going to be deploying it on their own systems, the connection back to that, if there's a problem, in two ways, one detecting that there's a problem, the other one is getting a fix out for the problem, is there's a lot longer of a cycle there. And so we've got to be a lot more careful about making sure that what we deliver out has been thoroughly tested, and that's why you have these longer test cycles for the box products, where we're running it through test labs and we've got betas, public betas, and that's kind of our testing in production there. Even that isn't a good high fidelity signal for what the real world looks like, as people aren't going to be running production workloads on top of the betas. So a very kind of different risk mentality when it comes to pushing out new code for the cloud versus the box product.
So let me ask you my dummy questions about this. So A, I think I hear you saying that Azure, of course, has virtual machines, and you're running a hypervisor in Azure that looks very, very, very much like Hyper-V.
Well, actually, I mentioned that we'd forked off, and then after the Server 2012 release, we've remerged. So now we're on stock Hyper-V and stock Server 2012. Right now in Azure, we're rolling out Server 2012 R2. And you can see that there's a bit of a lag there from us going from Server 2012 to Server 2012 R2. One of the reasons that in Azure we have a lag right now is the same reason that a lot of you guys have a lag in catching up with the latest release. And that is because these releases are big. They have a whole bunch of features in them. And they've got not intentional breaking changes, but changes, subtle changes to the way that the system behaves. And you want to make sure that it doesn't interfere with the assumptions and that your apps have taken on those behaviors.
Well, and you have big competition. You guys have insane competition. In that 2008, 2008 R2 are pretty gosh darn good server operating systems.
Yeah, but I'm actually even talking about where you've already bought in and say you're going to go to it. It's not like you say, oh, Server 2012, well, let's download that and blast it out, right? You want to make sure that it's not going to break anything, so you evaluate it. Make sure that your apps work with it. You understand if there's side effects. And there's always things that are going to break, you know, because of changes in the file structure. There's extra file here that this app didn't expect. We see the same thing when you get this big bundle of a release that has a whole bunch of changes in it. It's going to touch a whole lot of surface area, and that means that it's going to impact things. And so you identify all the things it impacts, and then you're like, okay, here's the set of things that we need to go and tweak to make it work properly and make it work efficiently. And that takes some time, too. And so that's why we're in this process now of rolling out Server 2012 R2. What we want to get to is a model where even server products are released and the box products are released much more frequently. So there's two streams. The one where, like for us in Azure, they're delivering it to us much more quickly. So here's a few updates. Here's some small set of features. And that lets us have us be much more quick about absorbing it, because if there is a change or a break, we can adapt, fix for that, and then push it out right away. It's not like this giant bundle that comes. And related to that, we've come up with a slogan kind of in the cloud: to go fast, you got to go fast.
I want to talk to you about it all night, but we can't. Short other follow-up question. For you as a computer scientist, one of the smartest guys around when it comes to this stuff, you've done software development. My thesis is that the current model of server every 2 years, but you miss stuff off the cliff, versus let's do it every 2 weeks and pick out the good stuff, I'm theorizing that the cloud is a better software development platform. Is that correct? Are we getting more done per day on Windows on the cloud than we would have if we were on the 24-month cycle?
In that type of engineering system?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. For the reasons that I've told you.
Sure.
I just need a
yes or no.
Yeah.
We got to move on.
Okay, sorry.
there's an interesting article there. So, all right, that's great. Well, along those lines, so you talked about how the cloud is feeding into server, but server's big brother is System Center. Is the Azure, what's the thing in Azure that's like System Center?
So we don't have anything that fully replaces all of the System Center functionality in the cloud yet at this point. So one of the things that System Center will do is orchestrate a rollout of a complex multi-VM application. Sure. You see our first step to orchestration system in Azure with what we call resource groups, which we announced at Build. The ability to, with a template, define a complex application that consists of different types of resources, and not just your traditional IaaS resources of VMs and storage and network, but in this first release of resource groups we did at Build, it's websites, it's SQL databases, it's TFS, test integration, and you're going to see us flesh that out to include all these other resources, and then that's all going back to the on-premises environment through something called the Windows Azure Pack.
Okay, but this stuff isn't, I'm sorry, I'm just keeping it along. This stuff isn't going back into System Center.
It's not going back into System Center. What you're going to see is the evolution and migration of functionality that System Center provides into things like
the Azure Pack.
Like the Azure Pack and these orchestration systems.
Azure Pack, for those who don't know, if you're building your own private cloud with System Center, which you can, there's some great stuff there, but the nice front end that you get in Azure, you can have on your on-premises as well. So it's great. It's a nice environment, the same UI. Terrific, good. Let's do some bigger stuff. I'm the cloud Gnostic. Mark and I are good friends, and for the last 3 years since he joined the group, whenever I'm in town, we have dinner and I tell him what a terrible idea Azure is. And 3 years ago I said, it can't do this, it can't do that, it's never gonna go anywhere. What I did not reckon with is the fact that if Azure doesn't do something, wait 2 weeks. Because seriously, how many of you use Azure pretty regularly? Okay, for those who don't know, when you get onto the Azure portal, it never looks the same. It's like if you're going to take a screenshot on it, in 2 weeks it looks different, you know? The thing, though, that's made me believe in the last couple of weeks that we're going or not isn't even those technologies. It's the fact that every time I turn around, they've cut the prices in half. I never imagined that the reason we're all going to end up going to the cloud is at some point it's going to be so cheap, your boss is going to come to you and say, all my golf buddies have cut their IT budget by 80% by going to the cloud. And you can make all the arguments about the security you want. The boss is going to say, if we're secure but we're out of business, it doesn't matter, right? So you guys are going to win. Why is the cloud inevitable? You're the expert here, not me.
Well, you're the economist, right?
Yes.
But I think a lot of it is economics. It is the... So once you get to a certain scale, there's a few things that happen. One is that to even get to scale, the only way to get to scale is actually to automate and to take humans out of the picture. This drives, and if you look at the cost per server in a typical IT infrastructure, a large part of that cost is the humans that are sitting in and managing and configuring and maintaining, troubleshooting those systems. When you get to a cloud scale of the kind that we've been talking about, you can't have humans running around doing those things on all the servers. We've got data centers like this one we announced in Des Moines. It's a $1 billion data center footprint we announced a few weeks ago. And unfortunately, the number of jobs that's going to create in the Des Moines area, around 60 for a $1 billion data center. And that's because there's very few people actually in the data center.
Won't there be a lot more work at the electric plant?
Yeah, there will be a lot more work at the electric plant. And the water plant.
And the water plants, exactly.
But for one, you've got to automate, and that drives the cost of computing down. And the only way you can get good at automating is to force yourself to automate because you want to get to scale. And the other aspect that comes with the scale is the supply chain efficiencies. The fact that when you're making orders for servers that big, you end up doing two things. One is you end up starting to make your own servers and not going to, you know, the way that you go to, you know, online website and buy a server there, because that's not the most efficient. You see all sorts of markups, you know, just for the fact that they got the website selling it to you, there's a markup there. So you build your own servers, and you buy in bulk, where you can get these incredible deals of, hey, we're going to buy this many, we're going to buy 100,000, so we need to get an awesome price on the 100,000.
So you're buying zillions of servers, you're automating, and you're saving per unit.
That's right.
And the increasing returns to scale, I'll be the economist now, means that the per unit cost goes down. And the most interesting part is that means the bigger you are, the lower the per unit cost. And what does that do to your competitors? It means that in an increasing returns to scale economy, ultimately it wants to be a monopoly, or certainly an oligopoly. So that'll lead to another question in a minute. Why you guys? But, you know. Scale means cheaper expansion, and this then drives your pace of change, basically.
Yeah. So,
do you guys have plans about that? Do you have a plan where you say, this is how we're going to continue to change?
What kind of change are you talking about?
Well, I know that a few years ago, the first time I heard the cloud was that all of your executives had gone off to some retreat, and they came up with like five scenarios of where IT would be in the future. And one of them wasn't called the cloud, but ultimately they were talking about some people would be all on-prem and some folks would be in the cloud. So I'm wondering, do you guys have visions for the future that how there'll be structural change?
Well, our vision is that there's going to be an on-prem for foreseeable future, in the indefinite future. If you look at the previous disruption, which was the mainframe to client server disruption, we're not done with mainframes. There's still a lot of places out there that have mainframes operating. And I think you'll still see 50 years from now the traditional on-prem kind of data centers that are still operating because they've been chugging along just fine, and the software there, no need to invest any more in it and leave it go, and let's just keep it humming along. But and this disruption is kind of interesting because it's this, it's kind of like a, you see a kind of a hockey stick. I mean, we're still at the beginning of it. We've been a few years into it as people started to talk about cloud, and now these massive clouds are starting to build up. But we're still haven't hit the inflection point of the rising scale. Like I mentioned, doubling every year for the foreseeable future is what we're going to be doing. So that tells you that we're on this exponential rise to the cloud. But we also see that on-prem is still going to be growing for the next few years as well, because there's a lot of business, a lot of processes, a lot of technologies that are invested in on-prem environments, and they're not just going to suddenly take all that and go to the cloud. But what is going to happen is that the cloud is going to be growing at a much, much faster rate than on-prem. So the way that I see it is the center of gravity is moving. And the center, you know, there's the on-prem, which has got the center of gravity closer to on-prem now, but as the cloud scale picks up and as more moves to the cloud, that center of gravity is moving. That's where all the money is going to go. That's where all the innovation is going to go.
Do you guys have a feel about how people get into the cloud? So if anybody here is thinking, wow, this is interesting, we'd like to try. I've never heard of any company of any size saying, well, Monday we're going. You know, is there a way to get your toe into the water? How do companies get their toe into the water?
I've been told that I need to move my mic. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Let me adjust this. So the question, is that better? No, just kidding.
Here, talking to my mic. Don't tweet that. Mary Jo's watching, you know.
All right, so the question was, how to get started in the cloud?
No,
How do we see people get started in the cloud?
I'm saying, you do everything.
Yeah.
You see the coding in Azure, you talk to people, you probably talk to people about the cloud more than almost anybody at Microsoft. So I guess my question to you, which is out of left field, we didn't practice this one, is
great.
How do people get their toe in the water? I mean, like, you know what? Yeah. What's the path? Yeah, like, give me some scenarios.
Yeah, well, I one of the most common paths that we see is the people that are going to do dev test in the cloud.
Okay, great.
Because if you talk about a dev test, which is I've got an app, a line of business app I want to create for my on-prem environment, you know, you go through the whole IT procurement, and that's going to take a while. But your developers, if they're going to do dev test and they can go to the cloud, spin up VMs within minutes, and start to do their development there while they're waiting for the IT resources to come online for the actual production deployment, they're off and running, not having to wait for this thing back to on-prem. They're doing it agilely in the cloud. Anybody that has security concerns, well, you're not really taking any production, you know, any of your real data up into the cloud to run in that dev test environment. These guys can iterate quickly. When they're done with their tests, when they're done with their dev, they shut down the VMs so they're not incurring costs for that. And then eventually when the VMs or the servers are ready on-prem and the app's been ready, it's already ready to go, you bring it back to on-prem. So very kind of easy way, low-risk way to get started with the cloud. And that we see that is like one of the first ways that
with respect, that sounds like a stealth way to get people into the cloud. You say, you're just coming here to build the app. You can move it when it's done, or you could stay. You could stay. Does that work?
Yeah,
does that happen?
That works too. The other one is using the cloud for DR site. Like, we're not going to really move to the cloud. Let's just create a DR solution that points at the cloud, but we're going to keep our stuff on-prem. And then one day that you have a failure on-prem, the stuff DRs to the cloud, and it's like,
That was easy.
That was easy. We might as well just leave it there.
Yeah, and you guys can go.
Yeah.
Remember, if you want to be the two people that are left, learn PowerShell. Yeah. That's important. So you've got me believing we have to do the cloud, but it's a little like facing death or disease. There must be, I think, 5 stages of this.
Yeah.
Like, denial, I think, would be like, yeah, right, we're going to go to the cloud. You're serious?
That's true. I see this a lot. Any deniers, any people in here that are like, no, the cloud is not really going to happen. All right, we're past that phase now. Because 4 years ago, there would have been a lot of hands raised. And how many, actually, just out of curiosity, how many people 4 years ago would have been saying, the cloud, this is ridiculous, it's not going to happen? Yeah.
So if denial is, you're not going to do the cloud, you're going to, really? Okay, what's the next one? Is anger.
Anger, yeah.
What would anger be?
Damn it. I don't want to go to the cloud.
What, you have some reasons?
Yeah.
You read Gartner? It would be Gartner.
It's all these people talking about this stupid cloud.
From there, we'd have like bargaining, right?
Yeah.
You know, and what do you suppose bargaining?
You know what? How about I create a great private cloud on top of OpenStack, and it'll save us a lot of money. It'll be just as cheap as going to the public cloud, and we'll still have all the control we want.
And we won't have to lay people off.
Yeah, we'll have to lay people
off. Hate that. Okay, that's good.
How's that? Anybody in that phase? Okay, a few people.
Fourth phase is what? Depression.
Yeah.
That's update resume.
That is, yeah. I think that there's a lot of people in that one. The tone is like, oh no, I'm going to be obsolete. I don't know what to do. How do I help my company move to the cloud? What's my job even with that? When things are in the cloud, what?
Can we ask that question?
Yeah.
Tell the truth. We won't let anyone know. How many of you are a little worried about the slightest bit worried, even a tiny bit about your job and the cloud? Is anybody even just? Not a lot of people. I see not a lot of people. That's interesting. I thought there would be years ago, but it dawned on me. You know, in the IT business, when do we get to do the same thing more than a year or so? You know, it's like you read a resume, somebody's resume that says, I've done the following job for 20 years. And you wonder whether they've just done the same job 20 times, you know, for, you know, 20 years at a time. And we can't do that in this business. Can you imagine any of us doing what we were doing 20 years ago in IT? It's inconceivable. I mean, I've often wondered if we could do a survey of Alzheimer's patients 30 years from now. We have to learn things all the time. I wonder if IT pros would be a much, and developers, would have a much lower incidence of Alzheimer's because we have to keep learning. How many people in their mid-40s have to go out and learn totally new stuff all the time? Maybe mid-30s, et cetera. Anyway, an acceptance would be what?
All right, let's figure out how to do this.
Oh, I was thinking acceptance would be, all right, does Microsoft have a certification in this? All right, so I'm going to go cloud.
Yeah.
Why you guys? Because I heard there's another company out of Seattle that's got books and stuff, and they've got a cloud.
Yeah.
The jungle way.
Well, you mentioned earlier oligarchy, And I think that this is
oligopoly.
Oligopoly. So that's what I meant. You with your fancy public school.
Oligarchy means rulers. Yeah, yeah. If you're suggesting you'll be ruling us, Mary Jo, are you listening?
Where's the blackout button? but I think there's, at this point, Brad Anderson mentioned it in the keynote, we believe that there's three players in this space. And,
okay.
And actually, this is a kind of a realization,
so who's
an emergence
who's the
over
you,
the last few.
You, Amazon, and?
And what's the third one? Google.
So you think Rackspace is going away? Well, no, wait.
Who?
Who? Yeah. Well, I mean, there are other cloud vendors. I mean, hell, CenturyLink thinks they're going to be a cloud vendor.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I find that. They were my phone company for a long time. Does anybody here work for CenturyLink? No, let's talk about them. why just three? I mean, why won't we keep extra ones? Why won't there be boutique cloud vendors?
Yeah, well, there might be in the short term, but I think long term, what you're going to see is that to be a player in the cloud, to be a partner, the outsourced partner for the companies that are represented in this room, you can't just have two data center deployments, one in Chicago and one in San Antonio. Not that I'm pointing out anybody, calling anybody out. You need to be everywhere. You need to have data centers in Europe, South America, North America, Australia, China, every place that business is, you need to be. You need to have a data center. And once you have that kind of global footprint.
Every place that business. What are you saying about Antarctica? What are you saying that Antarctica
We haven't announced anything yet.
Think
about
how
Antarctica.
Cheap cooling the machines would be.
Yeah.
I know what it is.
What?
In Antarctica, they have penguins.
Yeah.
That's.
We love penguins. Azure loves penguins.
Oh, okay. There we go then.
Yeah, we embrace Linux.
All right, so you guys are going to be a survivor.
And it's not just that. It's the global footprint, which takes a huge amount of capital. It's upfront capital that you're not going to get a return on for years. Building a data center takes 3 years. Reasonably sized data center is $1 billion of investment. And the kinds of companies that are generating that kind of cash to be able to fund multiple data centers being built out at the same time. And right now at Microsoft, we're probably building out 20-plus data centers right now around the world. Billions and billions of dollars. Google's also investing billions of dollars
Google's got that kind of money, though. Why can't they just double down and have twice as many data centers?
Yeah, well, I'm sure that they're working on it. So it ends up, like, how many companies can compete to get to that scale? Going back to the economics you were talking about, it just seems that if these small guys... And you mentioned boutique ones. Well, maybe there can be boutique ones in the short term. There can be the companies that say, you know what, I'm not going to be global. I'm not going to serve everybody. I'm not going to be the mass market cloud. But I'll be the little custom cloud that has a very specific certifications for a very particular vertical. Or my hardware is like always the best. It's like the 3-week-old hardware. It's the fastest cutting edge. So you want to come to the high performance cloud. This is it. I think you'll see things like that. But that's not sustainable long term.
So you're saying, one, there's going to be a winnowing, and you guys are going to be one of the ones that are left. Okay.
That's what I think, yeah.
Why you guys?
That's why I'm here at Microsoft.
Yeah. What's that?
That's why I'm at Microsoft, yeah.
I assumed it was just you couldn't do Linux. That's why you didn't go to Google.
I did Linux in grad school. I know how to do Linux.
No, that's true. That's true. Yeah. No, as I recall, you had something to do with kernel 2.4 and memory management,
if I
recall correctly. So in your spare time, because you wouldn't want to be doing that, on Microsoft time. So, global player. What else? So beyond being big, what are you guys going to do that Google and Amazon aren't going to do?
So we've got a few assets that those guys don't have. First of all, we've got a great connection with the people in this room through business relationships that we've already got established. We understand the enterprise. Most people in this room, or all the people in the room, are running Microsoft software in their existing data centers, and so this is a place where we can help our customers get to the cloud in a way that Amazon can't. Amazon doesn't have customers that are running Amazon software in their own data centers today. So for them, it's a, hey, come to our new world over here versus, I think we've got this chance to say, yeah, come over here, but it's going to look really familiar. And Google is in the same place. They have no IT presence whatsoever, so they've got that same deficiency in that area as well. The other thing that we've got related to this connection with the on-prem is Active Directory. This identity is the ability for to have your identities served up in the cloud through Azure Active Directory and Directory Sync, which people are already taking advantage of with Office 365, to be able to log in to cloud email using your on-prem Active Directory identities and credentials. And through that power federation, then SaaS apps federating with Office 365, Office 365 extensions like SharePoint Online extensions, all using the same role-based access control off that same identity system that people are leveraging. Instead of having to do federations with different identity providers, with different identities, and managing that kind of complexity, it's that center of gravity for identity, which is really, really important when it comes to mobile devices and apps, SaaS apps, on-premise infrastructure that already exists. So that's, I think, a really key differentiator. If you look at the rise of Windows in the server space, it was Windows plus email plus Active Directory as the identity. And those three combinations. And the way that I look at what's going on right now with Microsoft in this rebirth of Microsoft for the cloud, you see the same things. You see Azure as the new Windows, you see Office 365 as the new Office, and then you see Azure Active Directory as the equivalent of Active Directory. So I think that formula potentially could play out again.
So in a sense, you're saying that if I'm going to go to Amazon, instead of having, you're talking about the center of gravity moving, meaning that you can do that. You could be 30% on-prem and 70% in the cloud, but it's harder to do that in the Amazon world because since you guys own the software we're using anyway, you can then craft a cloud version, and that I'm oversimplifying, but in an Amazon world, you're going click. It's a quantum leap rather than a nice smooth leap, and that you can dial up on-prem versus in the cloud. Am I hearing that right?
You're hearing that right, and it's not just moving your existing stuff, but it's actually creating new software. So one of the questions that we've had a lot from you guys that are already looking at the cloud, and maybe you're not even ready to move to the cloud, but you're saying, how do we write software now so that when things do move to the cloud, that we're not having to rewrite everything to go to the cloud? And so we call this the cloud design point, the scale-out type of application architecture that's highly available and scalable and using PaaS middleware services. And we've just started this to try to give that to you through the Windows Azure Pack, for example. What you're going to see in the next year or 2 years is us to get a lot deeper into that system of providing a consistent experience for developers as the first higher order target, so that developers that you've got writing line of business apps can write an app in a way that makes it highly portable between your on-prem environment and the Azure environment. The second higher priority target is to make it so that you guys can manage those applications in the same way, whether they're running in Azure or your on-prem environment. And then the third way is to give your management interfaces that are somewhat consistent to manage the infrastructure underneath those things too. But so those are the two things, the application design points that are consistent as well as the management design points that are consistent across the two as much as possible.
So you're saying you end up with a data center that doesn't have as many players. That's a simpler relationship. All right, so let's say that I've surrendered. I'm going to the cloud. Security stuff.
Was that easy?
Well, no, it wasn't that easy. It's just that I guess I have. I got tired of running Exchange servers because you need like a guy and a half to do it, and I'm a small shop, so we didn't have a guy and a half. So, you know, Office 365 appears to keep getting cheaper and cheaper until eventually you guys will squeeze everybody else, you know, out of the business. But so at the same time, one of my directory services MVP brothers, Raymond Kervilius, is doing a talk where Raymond's thesis is, you guys are going to make a cloud that's secure. If it's not secure yet, you'll figure it out. Because if you don't, then Google will eat the world, or Amazon will, or whatever. So let's assume the cloud's pretty secure. That means the low-hanging fruit is where? On the desktop. Now, what does that... That seems to me that if there's a mass of hackers, a constant mass of hacking ability on the planet, that it's going to take its focus away from trying to take down web servers because it ain't going to be possible, and trying to take down routers because it ain't going to be possible, and start focusing on the client side. That's A. And B is the client side is getting, I can't think of a nice way to say it, stupider, because not the people, but the devices. I mean, an iPad is a lovely thing, but it's... I haven't used something with an operating system where apps just disappear on a regular basis, not even leaving a suicide note behind. I mean, I'm used to Dr. Watson. I mean, there's not even a nurse on call here, you know? And, And the idea that this is going to be the entryway into your nice, secure cloud, what does that mean? Does that mean that that you're going to have to get pickier about the clients you talk to? Will you guys need quarantine? Is this a stupid question?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he tried to present this question last night at dinner.
At dinner.
And I couldn't understand it then, and I still kind of can't understand it.
Is it just me?
Anybody understand that question?
It is just me. Okay, never mind. Sorry. Fine. Are you data mining our data? No. All right then.
But really, is there something there in that question? Weekend points in the implications for the cloud, you're saying.
Yeah.
But what I couldn't get out of that is exactly what kind of threat you're talking about with those weekend points. A way into customers' own data through a weekend point?
Something like that, yeah.
And I think there's a larger theme there that as much as Azure and other cloud providers can do to secure their own infrastructure and secure their own systems and give customers tools to help them secure their apps and their data, ultimately, we can't do it for them. They've got to secure their own. They've got to use those tools. They've got to ACL things. They've got to whitelist things. They've got to monitor things, detect things, if they want to be secure.
But my point is that you already do some of that. I'm not an Azure guy, but if it's anything like Office 365, I can't connect a device to Office 365 unless I agree to change this whole Exchange Active Sync stuff, where it's sort of like group policies light.
Yeah.
Light, very, very, very light, you know. And Intune is kind of something along those lines. I guess my question is, I mean, will that become a gateway? Is there going to be a point where you can't talk to Azure unless you're an Intune client or something along those lines?
Well, I think that you'll see a lot of binding of identity to devices. So you will only be able to access things from approved devices. And ideally, this will be transparent. I mean, is this app connecting through this to my app in the cloud? Is this client-side app connecting to my cloud service from a device that IT knows about? And not just because the app says, I'm coming from Mark's phone, but because the IT people have provisioned that phone with a secret that's bound in hardware that the phone has the app let the service prove the phone knows. And so it's this provable identity.
All right, let's move along. Okay. This is just, I don't think this
it's
is.
It went over his head, sorry.
Yeah, no, I got it. It was good dancing, I liked it. I'm always impressed.
Right.
So let's say I want to do this. Now, the way I'm going to get my feet in the water is I'm going to take my web server, which is currently a Server 2012 machine. It is a virtual machine, and I want to get it up to the cloud. How hard is that?
It depends.
Oh, well, good. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know you were a consultant.
Yeah.
That's my job.
Yeah.
No, seriously. So it's currently built. Yeah. If it's a super simple website.
This is your website you're talking about.
Use me kind of as an example. I'm saying, I'm trying to think of cases where I don't really have an application that needs to scale enough that it's worth me spending 6 months or 3 months or whatever to take my SQL-based stuff and run it off Azure SQL. I mean, I think, remember that there's only 500 of the Fortune 500. You guys only sell to 498 of them because you don't sell to yourself and you couldn't give a hoot about Apple. So, once you get beyond those guys, you want to be able to penetrate further. And I mean, maybe your model in 5 years, 10 years is say, hey, medium-sized businesses that aren't doing line of business stuff or you're not really used to it, we've got something that makes it even easier to do it. And then maybe you press further down into small business or something. Or, for example, you guys created an amazing ecosystem with small business servers. There's my example. I know billions of people that have about 30 clients, and they get a check from there every month, and they look after their small business server. And these people don't have blue badges, but they're trusted individuals that are working kind of as agents of Microsoft. And again, creating the ecosystem, that sort of thing. In 10 years, maybe we'll have a world where even somebody who wants a small line of business app, that there are simple tools where someone on that scale could go and help those folks, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying, but another example is, you've already got something running. We already have our own server, it's our web server, it's our whatever else server, and I want to take, and we made it a virtual machine, or we've done something to it, maybe it's a VMware machine, and we ran that wizard you guys had that converts VMDKs into VHDs, and I want to upload it to the cloud. Is it possible at all, first of all?
Yes, it's possible. One of our goals, actually, with infrastructure as a service was to make it highly portable, to make those VM images highly portable between the cloud and on-premises. So I think if you take a Hyper-V image, it's got the integration components in it, that's all you need. You take that VHD and upload it to Azure Blob Storage.
Are there different integration components for Azure than for Hyper-V?
No, they're the exact same ones.
So I don't have to take them out, upload it,
nothing.
Install new ones?
No install. You take literally that image that was running VM on in your virtual machine manager 1 minute, copy it up to the cloud, launch a VM from it, and get it running in the cloud. Assuming that there's no interesting dependencies on the on-prem environment
sure.
inside that OS that's running inside that.
So if I've written some crappy code where I've hard-coded the static IP address,
yeah,
clearly that's an issue. But hang on.
Yeah.
I'm remembering something.
Yeah.
I built an Azure VM like when you guys first made it legal a year ago or something like that. And I had the darndest time because I was trying to get a static address. And you can get one, but it changes. So
yeah.
It's not really static, it's just kind of noisy, you know? And so, what's the alternative to static? Anyway, so,
dynamic.
It was supposed to be funny, it didn't work, sorry. So you get static, but they're not really static. Are we ever going to be able to see a static address in Azure?
Well, let's talk about why you want a static address first.
Because they do.
Okay.
No, I don't know. I mean, I may have...
So demanding.
I just do. I feel more comfortable when I... That's something.
All right, well, if you're going to explain it, I'll explain why I think people like static IP addresses.
Okay.
So,
I'm listening.
Yeah, okay. Just want to make sure.
All right.
So a static IP address is that's a public IP address that you can take and assign to different virtual machines. So you can assign it to this virtual machine today, assign it to a different virtual machine tomorrow, delete this virtual machine, create a new one, and then take that same IP address and assign it to it. That's a static IP address.
Yes.
As opposed to the kind of IP addresses that Azure Cloud Services and VMs have had, which is an IP address that is stable and yours as long as you've got the VM deployed attached to.
In other words, shut the VM off,
if you
turn it back on,
and you'll get a different IP address.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So the reason why people like a constant IP address for that case where they might want to shut the VM down and then start it up later or create a new VM is because they like they'll set up firewall rules on their on-prem routers to only allow traffic from that IP address to the cloud or vice versa.
Okay.
And so if the IP address is constantly changing, they need to update their firewall rules. So get a static IP address, configure the firewall rules, and now you can take this IP address and use it however you want to without having to do reconfiguration.
Well, no, hang on.
Yeah.
Within the hardening manuals you guys have put out in the last 14 years, there's stuff like, I haven't done this in a while, so I'm not going to misremember, but with SMTP servers, for example, you can do things like one of the things to harden to say, I'm only accepting mail from, the way that you ensure that someone's not coming from the outside is this given subnet. So, and that stuff really only supports IP addresses.
Yeah.
What it means, it's not the end of the world, but it's just the concern.
Yeah, well, that's the mail server firewall, basically.
No, I'm just saying that there are firewall-y things that are relevant to certain applications.
Right.
Lots of Microsoft server tools will allow you to talk to blocks of IP addresses and ignore everybody else. And it's not just mail, it's not just web. It's a lot of them. And so, I mean, I could see where people would say, all right, I don't like doing this. If I move to the cloud, I'm going to get a different static address, but please don't change it every week.
Right.
You know? And when you talk about turning a VM off, help me out here.
Yeah.
If you want a patch, that means you're essentially rebooting. Doesn't that mean you lose your IP addresses?
No, not for a reboot.
Reboot's fine. It's an actual shutdown that scatters all the addresses.
Right.
Okay. So let's assume I want a static address and I want it to remain static, eponymously static.
Yeah.
Is there something like that possible in Azure?
There is. I'm glad you asked because on Monday we announced it.
You mean this Monday?
Yeah, this Monday.
Just 2 days ago?
Yes.
Wow. So it's as if I've first heard of this now. So tell me how much. I mean, I know ISPs want like $25 a month for a static address or $100 a month for a static address.
So we give you 5 IP addresses for a subscription free.
Okay.
So you can assign those to any virtual machine or cloud service and have that be static. Five.
Five?
Five IP.
What did that cost?
Zero.
I get 5 static addresses?
Yeah.
What's the catch? You get to put advertising on anything that goes
That's
out?
That's right, We inject packets into your stream. No catch. That's it.
How many Azure subscriptions are there roughly at the moment? Give me an order of magnitude. 10, 100,000, 10,000, 100,000,
Keep going
million,
up, keep going up.
A million?
Yeah.
Huh?
So, somewhere in that neighborhood. Yeah.
That's 5 million static IP addresses?
If everybody went in,
where on earth did you guys get?
If everybody ran for their IP addresses,
they will after they see this broadcast. This is not just this room, Mark. It's going to the whole internet. People turn, wave, hi, internet. So, this could be the dumbest thing you've ever announced in public.
Could be. Thanks for highlighting that.
I'm here for you all the time, big guy. So, where? No, seriously. I mean, I keep hearing there was a really
good... Well, you're the one that gives the IPv6 talk.
I know. I heard a great IPv6 talk in, like, what was it, Orlando 5 years ago, where some guy with a beard was saying...
And he said, IPv4 is running
24
out.
Minutes, and, 24 minutes. 24 minutes. We keep hearing, where are you getting all these IPv4 addresses?
Yeah, black market. Yeah.
There's a black market for IP addresses? I had no idea. Do they make you do things, or do they take... I'll bet you paid him in Bitcoin. Smart. Good move. Good
untraceable.
Move.
Untraceable.
Smart. Smart move.
Yeah.
Seriously, where'd you get these from?
No, you actually, there's big blocks that telcos put on the market, that ISPs put on the market.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
And they auction them up. Companies going, Nortel sold a,
Really?
When they had problems, they were like, fire sale, IP addresses.
I was thinking like that. Now that they're shutting down all the, the Nigerian spam places, that maybe you were getting those
used IP addresses.
And you can get them cheap because they're in every blacklist on every router in the world, right? They're a whole router question. Uppercase only or uppercase and lowercase? That's interesting. Well, that's cool. So once I get that, you could probably go on for hours.
But they are getting more expensive. That's for sure.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I assume that Azure supports IPv6 if we need it. I mean, I spent like 20 minutes.
How many people are on IPv6 in your enterprise?
Are those crickets? Yeah. Are those crickets? I a short story. I spent 20 minutes in the future just recently. My Verizon hotspot.
Can I go with you next time?
Yes, absolutely. My Verizon hotspot sometimes stops giving out IPv4 addresses and only V6 addresses. I didn't know that. So I'm Googling, and I'm getting my answers. I'm going to Microsoft. I'm getting my answers. I'm going to my site because my cable company, don't tell anybody, it's Cox, doesn't give out V6 addresses yet. So I couldn't get to like two-thirds of the, like 90% of the sites, and I realized I could only get to the V6 sites. I had spent 20 minutes in the future.
I'm impressed you figured that out.
It's only because I read his blog. Okie dokie. So, talk a little bit more about moving a VM up. Have you done it yourself?
Yeah, I've done it.
Okay. Wrinkles? I mean, is there something everybody does wrong?
No, I mean, the VM that I moved up was a fairly simple one. I mean, I just wanted to see for myself that it actually works. I don't have a complex on-prem, VM-based application that I needed to move. But you talked about gotchas. I mean, there are some gotchas. If the server that you've got, the VM that you've got, is using certain features that aren't supported in Azure's VMs, then it's not going to be able to move. Like, one that we don't have today is the ability to support multiple NICs on the VM.
What? You can only have one NIC?
You can only have one NIC on the VM. Yeah, there's only one NIC on the VM today. Actually, there's two in the case of our A8 and A9s, but one's an InfiniBand NIC.
Oh, so we can do RDMA. That's cute.
Yeah. Huh?
What if I needed something that had two NICs? What then?
Don't put me on the spot. No, it's coming.
I think Amazon has multiple NICs. Actually, I do not know that. I just made that up. Don't tweet that. Now, one thing, a good friend of mine, one of the smartest guys in the world about cloud and stuff like that, Aidan Finn, who I think is in the room. You guys don't read Aidan's blog? You should. Anyway, so Aidan tells me that backup's an issue in virtual machines. So let's say I were to build a virtual, and the only reason I agree with him is that, or I believe him, is that every cloud I've seen, moving the data into the cloud is free, but you want it back?
Yeah. And so,
we offer loans at reasonable rates. So I'm assuming any kind of backup tool I'm going to use is I'm going to want to move it out of the machine. Like, for example, the easiest example I can think of is I build a virtual machine that's just my backup rail. Is it going to cost me a lot of money to move the data off of my virtual web server over to my virtual backup rail, all within Azure? Within the same, what's the word?
Region?
Subscription.
Region.
Subscription?
No. Well, actually, let me understand, where is this?
Okay. I'm imagining I have some server, okay?
Okay.
And I want to back it. Where is it? It's an Azure virtual machine.
Okay, it's an Azure virtual machine.
And Northeast US or something like that. I don't know what your data centers are called. You have one in the Northeast?
No.
Okay, well, Dublin. I know there's one in Dublin. So the latency between that and the East Coast isn't too bad. So I set up a server there. That's my web server. People are buying my stuff. Life is good, but... Mm-hmm. I worry about backup.
Okay. Now, what kind of backup are you going for? You're going for a backup that I accidentally delete something?
So currently,
Dublin blows up?
Well, I assume Dublin blows up is your problem.
Well, it's your problem if it's your data there.
Fair point. But I'm kind of assuming that you guys have Dublin backed up somewhere.
Dublin's got a problem too. That happens.
Because if not, this is going to be a short talk. You're saying Dublin goes down?
So we do have asynchronous geo-replication for storage accounts. So if your storage account that you create that VM VHD in, it has geo-rep enabled, which costs a little bit extra.
Oh, okay.
Then it's asynchronously replicated to Amsterdam in that case of Dublin.
So by default, if I build in Dublin and I don't do the async the thing you just said, okay?
Then your data stays in Dublin.
Data stays in Dublin, okay. And in unlikely event that a meteor hits Dublin, then just too bad.
Right.
Okay, all right, good. Let's assume that I think the probability of that's pretty low.
Okay.
And I'm gonna stay within Dublin.
Yeah.
Okay. So I decide the way to do it, to spread out my risk a little bit, is to create another machine, a virtual server, let's say, just to act as a backup collector thingy. And I run just Windows Server backup, which works perfectly well, or something like that, data replication.
Yeah.
Something insane like that, okay? That seems like one answer that you may tell me is a stupid answer. It could well be a stupid answer, but I understand the tools right now, and I'll get to it, right?
Yeah.
It's one of those things. If both virtual machines are both running in Dublin, and I move the data back and forth, am I charged for that?
No.
You're not, okay.
Not within the same region. Traffic is free.
All right, good. So it only gets costly if I decide I need something.
Yeah, if you were doing it, if you did set that arrangement up between Dublin and Amsterdam, then you'd be playing network egress and storage ingress charges
cool
for that.
Well, one of the things that I really like about Server 2012 is that I can run a really cheap and very reliable data center in my garage. And what I do is I've got another machine that didn't cost anything, and I do Hyper-V replication, which we first got in 2012, which is just it's really cool. I mean, the idea is, for those who haven't played with it yet, the idea is if you're the cheapest person in the world, you have a virtual machine somewhere, you get another Hyper-V server, you replicate your virtual machine over, that takes time the first time, and then every 5 minutes, or in 2012 you can adjust it, it just does the updates, bam, bam, bam. The meteor flies in the window, blows up your one machine, you don't have a cluster, you just walk over and say, start this virtual machine up. Even better, it will remember the last 10 snapshots or something like that. So if the thing that blew it up was me doing something stupid, I can not only restore things, I can go to the Wayback Machine. So it's cheap, it's wonderful. Large organizations wouldn't do it, small organizations would. Mm-hmm. Can you do something like that in Azure?
You can. So there's Azure Site Recovery, which we announced the new name change for Hyper-V Replica.
Oh, so you have Hyper-V Replica in Azure then?
Yeah.
All right.
And we announced that the name
has changed. But you don't
call
it Hyper-V Replica.
It's called
Azure
Site Recovery. Yeah, we could. But we didn't. And then there's third parties that are also doing backups and disaster recovery to the cloud. Like Symantec has announced an Azure disaster recovery product that they announced at their Symantec Vision conference last week.
So presumably I would be
through a partnership with Azure, actually, it's targeted specifically at the Azure cloud. So taking an on-prem deployment of virtual machines and pointing it and having it back up and fail over to Azure.
And so, like, these guys would have an instance at Dublin, for example, and so if I backed up to them, I'm not looking at big charges. Is that how it works? Or would that not be true?
Wait, what I just talked about was the on-prem to Azure.
Oh, on-prem, okay, got it, okay.
Backup.
So they don't have something in Azure,
Azure
per
right,
se.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, that's good. That's fascinating. So that's great stuff. Those are all things that make me think, like, this could be something I could possibly do in a weekend or something like that.
Yeah.
Azure's open on the weekend, right?
Yeah.
Just checking in.
Pretty much. But you also should look at, one of the easier ways to even move a typical client web database application is to not even go full bore on a virtual machine.
Right.
But if you're using ASP.NET or Node.js, is just to go to Azure websites with SQL Azure on the back end, especially if it's a relatively small thing.
Right. No, I did not mention that. But yeah, one of the first Azure services we ever saw were Azure websites.
Yeah.
And if it's, in the simplest case, if it's all static HTML, I could just copy a www root up to there and pretty much be done.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
Sure. No, I'm assuming we have, what if you built a website on, let's say, classic ASP, because 14 years ago you heard from Microsoft that it would be supported forever and it was the best tool around.
I think that'll still work inside
really?
The website, yeah.
Very nice, very nice, cool. Now that backup stuff all sounded like security. We should talk about security.
Mm-hmm.
So, you are talking about cloud security tomorrow.
I am.
What time?
It's actually this afternoon at 3:15, I think.
This afternoon at 3:15. Yeah. So let's do a little bit of it, though.
Why don't we see, how many people are concerned about the cloud because of security is the number one concern?
Security
is one
of the reasons.
Okay,
sounds good.
They're concerned.
I mean, why should I believe that you won't lose my data?
You shouldn't be concerned, by the way.
These aren't the fears you're looking for. Well, there's a number of things. First of all, there's the multi-tenanted thing, which is that fancy name you guys came up with back in 2012 days.
It says,
wait a minute, my competition's running a virtual machine on the same physical host as I am. How hard is it? I mean, have people...
Let me ask this. How many people are concerned, one of your security concerns with the cloud is the multi-tenancy aspect of it, is that storage service is managing data on behalf of lots of different customers, and what if the storage service screws up and gives me somebody else's data? Or my virtual machine is sitting on a server next to somebody else's bad virtual machine and somehow that exposes me. How many people are concerned about that aspect of it? So not that many people.
So
let's skip that one then. No, I'm just kidding.
That's a great scenario. Let's lay that out. So one possibility is there's a bug in Azure, somebody figures it out, and they figure out a way to read from any data store inside Azure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and bad things, hilarity ensues, right? Or what it's just a situation where there's no malice at all. You guys just, there's a bug. We're talking about the yeasty froth and change of code. 1-2 week period, there's this code where I just see everybody's stuff. What should we be worried about there? I mean,
So we haven't seen any bugs like that, and the code is designed not to have those kinds of bugs. That said, it is code, and there is the risk of that showing up. It'd be pretty catastrophic for us, which is why we take that so seriously and try to make sure that those kinds of bugs don't show up. So the first is the storage service showing you somebody else's stuff. I mean, that would be pretty catastrophic. Because one of the things we haven't mentioned is when you're going to a public cloud provider, when you're basically outsourcing your data, you're outsourcing your business at that point, and you're taking a mission critical bet. Like once you're at the point where if the cloud provider dies or screws up and your business is in trouble, then you know that you're kind of married at that point. And we know at Microsoft the only way we're going to get a cloud business that has people trust us to run their code and to put their data in us is to establish that trust through making screw-ups like that. Because if we make a screw-up like that, that could be it for us. I mean, not just us, but it had implications across the whole cloud. There's been a number of cloud outages, for example. Like Amazon's had one, a few. We've had a few. And whenever those things, we haven't had one in a while, fortunately, a big one, either us or Amazon. But when those things were happening, people were saying, wow, this really is going to make everybody take a step back from the cloud. If we're that dependent on these guys and they're screwing up like that, then maybe we should just hold off. As much as economically it looks like it makes sense, they're not mature enough.
And it really just takes one.
Yeah.
In the mainframe world, there was a fire in the Transamerica Pyramid, I believe it was. Bank of America lost their data center, the whole mainframe. This is ages and ages ago. And all of a sudden, Iron Mountain appears.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, people start buying tapes. All of a sudden, backups. People really need to see a disaster to really get scared about it.
Yeah.
So I almost wish there were a disaster now.
In the early days.
Yeah, when there are only 5% of the people in the cloud, so that by the time the rest of us get in there, that there will be a good... Do you guys think about that? Do you think about scenarios like that?
We think about it, I mean, all the time. We're thinking about those kinds of worst-case scenarios. Knowing that a screw-up where it becomes clear that we didn't think about it, we didn't take steps to prevent it, where it it would be perceived as incompetence, that'd be the end of the business. Really, that'd be the end of the cloud business at Microsoft and potentially even Microsoft at that point, if we lost trust.
What, not just that, but other vendors as well. People are logically going to say, the Microsoft guys...
Who cares about those guys?
Oh, okay. Excuse me.
No, but there would be collateral damage.
I assume that ultimately I'll end up in the Amazon web because I'm a Prime subscriber and I'm thinking I'll get a good deal as a result. I can get the cloud overnight. Beat that.
4K streaming, they'll throw that in too.
There you go, exactly. Oh, that's a great idea. So we haven't seen something like that yet.
It's a huge worry for us. And you'll see me, if you come to my talk this afternoon. Are you coming to my talk this afternoon?
Probably.
Okay. Is that a yes or
yes,
no?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yes.
I do talk about this
I never miss one of your talks.
That's not true.
Sometimes they put me against you.
That's not the only reason.
So, as I was saying, are you coming to my talk tomorrow? Modern apps for IT pros.
What time is it?
It's first thing in the morning. Don't tell me you're talking against me.
8:30? No, I tell them I don't want that slot.
Oh, is that right? You don't want that slot. You know how he used to do internals talks about how Windows works? Now he's doing this cloud stuff. I'm picking up the slack for him. I'm doing an internals talk about those Metro apps. Come on down, join me wherever I am, 8:30. Early.
Probably in this room.
One of those places. Yeah. Let me take it a step further, though.
Yeah.
And we weren't going to talk about this, but I heard this from three people. And everybody asked me this. The question is, I know you can't answer the question without losing your job, but do you have the Microsoft line on the following question? Do you data mine our stuff? And I'll tell you why I asked the question.
Yeah.
Back in Madrid, mm-hmm. I was sitting in an Office 365 talk, just intro to Office 365, and somebody, and the European audience is a little tougher than the American audience, and this one guy stood up and said, "Are you data mining our data?" And the... Dieter, I think his name was Dieter. And this is like some poor American, the guy's like 18, program manager for Office 365. No, seriously, he's got like tattoos and shrapnel and stuff. And I didn't mean it that way. Hang on, anyway. There were magnets nearby. It was really weird. So, and I know what happened was he's like, "Crap, I don't know. I can't answer this." But he paused. I mean, he paused long enough that everyone in the room said, "Yes, they're doing it."
You got him.
So now that I got you on the hot seat, what's the official answer to that question?
First I'll say that there's more than...
He's equivocating. Yeah. God.
Well,
No, let's try this again.
No. Take Bing, for example. Is that your data? The searches that you do on Bing?
I'm not talking about that.
Yeah, that's part of the... When you say Microsoft Cloud, that's included.
No.
What data are you talking about?
I have an E colon on my virtual machine in Azure.
That sounds like a bad thing.
If it's on Azure, it replicates as well. It can spread to six continents. I just got to check a box. I'm doing that.
Yeah, I like that.
Come to his cloud talk next year. He's going to use that. He just files the serial numbers off my stuff.
They won't remember.
Remember what? Yeah. We're all stateless. Yeah. All right. I'm saying so.
What was your question?
You can't just keep asking. I'm going to keep asking. Yeah. So I've got E colon. It's got a SQL database on it.
Are we mining that data?
Yes.
That's on your E colon database.
That's correct.
No.
You're not?
No.
Okay. So as you're copying it, you're not even peeking?
No. No.
That's porn. No. You don't do that?
No.
Okay. All right, then. So I believe you. What about other security stuff? What about external forces? Like, you might have heard of this guy, Snowden.
Who?
And, but the NSA stuff.
Yeah.
Should we not be concerned about that? I mean, I personally think people are seeing the NSA stuff the wrong way. Because there's the obvious joke about, I crashed my server. You know, do you have the data, right, to the NSA? Seriously, there's a million jokes along those lines. What I want is if the NSA is reading my email, they could probably get all kinds of personality stuff of it. They should match me up with single women who think like I do. I would pay taxes. I would pay taxes for that. I mean, it would be just great.
Maybe they have. Yeah, maybe they have mined it, and they're, you haven't been contacted for a reason.
Why do I do this to myself? He does this. He wrote that. He's the first mark. Why am I always the second one? I'm alphabetical. All right, NSA.
Yeah.
What does it mean? So I think everybody's going to say, my feeling about the NSA stuff is that before we knew the NSA stuff, a year ago, you and I both knew that if the FBI shows up at, heck, an ISP, you know, a colo, forget a cloud, gives us a piece of paper, says, I want to toss Manassi's stuff, and if you tell him we did it, we'll put you in jail. That to me was an answer. This way they have to break into my garage to get my stuff. So at least I know they were there.
Yeah.
It feels like I have, you know, and maybe they've left the emails of the women, you know, there. And so, is the cloud like that? I mean, if people are ultra paranoid, shouldn't they be saying, we want our stuff on site because the FBI can't get it without our knowledge or something like that? Is that a reasonable question or is that another dumb question?
No, that's a reasonable question. How many people have that question, actually? All right, I was afraid of that. So it is a reasonable question, and it's one that I'm not going to make new news here by saying something that Microsoft hasn't already said publicly. Microsoft has taken a very strong position on this, and you can go read Brad...
Anderson.
No, not Brad Anderson.
Oh.
Brad Smith, chief legal counsel, blog posts on NSA as this stuff was happening last year, commitments to our customers about what we're going to do to fight for our customers' rights and their data, the privacy of their data with respect to governments that try to seek access to it. Our commitments in terms of encrypting customer data as it crosses wires that are out of our control, encryption at rest for your data, petitioning the government along with other big corporations that are in the same boat as us, that actually asking that we have the right to tell customers when the government's coming in and asking for their data. So we'd love it in a world where we could just keep your data completely isolated, completely safe, and no government could come and force us to give it up. You know, how long it's going to take us to get there and the nuances around this and the international legalities of this and even what's going on in the U.S., I can't speak to, but that's our intent and goal. And also our intent and goal is to come up with technologies that enable you to put data in our cloud that we can't get access to even if somebody came and put a gun to our heads. So that's where we're actually actively working on that as well.
Well, so and along those lines, there was an interesting incident just a couple of weeks ago, right? I believe it was in the Dublin data center. Do I have that right?
Which incident?
So I want to say it was a Dublin data center. Somebody said, give us this data. It's in the Azure data center in Ireland.
Yeah.
And the Microsoft answer was, no, yes, we're an American company, and yes, you have a gun, and you're an American officer, but it's in Ireland,
I mean,
which was an interesting response that hadn't happened before.
Yeah. So that's the kind of position that we're taking on it. You know, what we see some customers doing is encrypting the data on the way into the cloud, so they don't put any unencrypted data in the cloud just at this point, which is a first step of, I'm paranoid about this stuff, I do want to use the cloud, but I don't want to be exposed to something like that, and so encrypted on the way in and decrypted on the way out is what some customers are doing. I'd love for there to be a situation where that's not even necessary and you can send encrypted data into the cloud. The problem with that scenario, by the way, is you stick the encrypted data in the cloud and now you can't process it, because if you're going to process it, it needs to be clear, and so you can't do the processing on it in the cloud, and that kind of defeats a whole large reason that the cloud is being so disruptive. We didn't talk about the whole big data aspect of the cloud and all of the data that's being generated and mined and the Internet of Things data and business data that you need be able to have scalable compute to run over that data, and that's a perfect scenario for the cloud. So stick your encrypted data in the cloud if you really want it never to be in the clear, which you can never let it be in the clear if you want to make it so that nobody can ever get at it.
Sure.
Then you're just locked out of that kind of scenario. So that's what I say earlier, we're working on technologies, it's going to take a while, but where you can stick encrypted data in the cloud, then you can perform compute on it, and we still provably can't get access to that data, even though you're doing compute on it.
Cool. So, What about if you actually have, at some point, maybe hundreds of data centers, literally millions, maybe tens of millions of servers in 10 years, don't you guys become one of the favorites, targets for terrorism? I mean,
yeah.
Blowing you up would be as useful as blowing up a nuclear power plant.
That's true.
I said that on the internet. TSA, yeah. I didn't. Oh, yeah, never mind.
Have fun flying home.
Never mind. I understand property values in Houston are very good. A little humid here, you know?
Tell us what the back room looks like at the airport.
What color gloves would you like, Mr. Manassi? I don't have time for the story. Let's go. What were we saying?
Internet terrorist target.
No, I mean it's
being part of critical. I mean, it will be these massive geo clouds will be essentially critical infrastructure at that point. So many businesses, so much of the economy will depend on them running. So they make prime candidates. But this is not a new kind of threat either. We've got lots of critical infrastructure today that's already exposed to terrorist threats. We've got critical infrastructure today that I think is even more critical right now than the cloud, potentially even just as critical as it will be in the future, and yet not going to have the kind of redundancy and geo scale and DR story that we're probably going to have at that point. And I'll point right at the financial system as an example of that.
Huh?
Well, massive data centers sitting in northern New Jersey with no ability to fail over to any place else, realistically. This is not like a revelation. This was
sure.
Something that the 9/11 Commission looked at and said, we're vulnerable here.
Well, actually, I did some work on that. Yeah. You know, the whole story was there was the bungled attempt to bomb something in the World Trade Center, and I think in 93 or something,
yeah.
That woke them all up. And if it hadn't been for the bungled one, 9/11 would have been a complete financial nightmare. Now, I was assuming that you were going to tell me that with the wind down of the Iraq and Afghanistan, where there's a lot of Blackwater guys unemployed at the moment, and that they'd be the logical places to go. We have just a few minutes, so I want to ask you something off topic. I heard you've written some novels.
That's right.
Anybody here read Zero Day? All right. So the third one's out, and what's Jeff?
Jeff
Aiken.
Yeah, Jeff Aiken.
So what happens is Rogue Code is that a cloud story?
It no. Well, not really.
So the fourth one
is not a cloud story either.
Actually, really?
That's like a little.
It should be a cloudburst.
Yeah.
Zero Day : cloudburst.
Jeff saves the cloud.
Jeff Aiken runs for president.
Yeah.
Played by Alec Baldwin. It's not like any other thriller series I know of. So Rogue Code's out. Is it out now? The last time we talked.
It's actually officially out on May 20th.
Okay.
But I got the publisher to send a few hundred copies to the local bookstore here on site to make it available here. So I'm doing a book signing at noon, actually. So in about half an hour.
At noon. At noon. Okay then.
And then I'm doing another. If you can't make that one, I'm doing it again. Another signing tomorrow, at noon too. And then if you miss those two, you can just bring by the book whenever and.
Just a minute and 50 seconds, and I really want to ask all of you. This is something Mark and I have been doing, and I'm really enjoying it. I know he has fun with it. We'd like to know if you do. The evaluations are very, very important. And you know the ones, the twos, the fours, whatever, that's important stuff, and we hope you give us good numbers. But what I really want is when you take a moment and write a comment, if you really liked something so much that you want, do you want to see this again? What do you guys think? How do we do? All right. So... Right, stop. Give us comments. What you liked, what you didn't like. That feedback's so important. You can get me at mark@manassi.com. You are available, or you can be tweeted to, or something like
Mark that. mark@manassi.com.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. You know, we'd love to hear the feedback on this. And other than that, please join me tomorrow if you would. And other than that, let me just close by saying thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark. It's been
fun. And everybody,
yeah.
Remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. Thank you. Bye-bye.